Hi, this is Ted, and for the next hour, you'll be listening to a reading of articles and features from the Monday, November 10th New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And we'll start with a front page article that says, U.S. tells states to undo moves on food stamps. The Trump administration told states that they must immediately undo any actions to provide full food stamp benefits to low-income families in a move that added to the chaos and uncertainty surrounding the nation's largest anti-hunger program during the government shutdown. The Agriculture Department issued the command late Saturday in a memo, which the New York Times later viewed. That guidance threatened to impose harsh financial penalties on states that did not comply quickly with the new federal orders. The memo surprised, vexed, and frustrated many state leaders, and by Sunday, some had begun to explore their legal options to prevent any further disruptions to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. But the Trump administration held firm in its refusal to fund food stamps in full, telling the court in a strongly worded filing that states would be responsible for the consequences of their actions. Caught in the middle were the roughly 1 in 8 Americans who depend on monthly federal assistance to purchase groceries, aid that has been imperiled for days in a record-long shutdown. Multiple lawsuits to loosen that money remained unresolved, leaving many families at growing risk of hunger and financial hardship. Some of the 42 million people enrolled in SNAP began to receive their full benefits on Friday after a federal judge ordered the Trump administration to fully fund the program this month amid the shutdown. New York, Oregon, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin were among states that raced to release the aid to residents, some of whom had been without nutrition assistance for days. Soon after, though, the Supreme Court temporarily paused the judge's order so that an appeals court could further review it, leaving the entire program in legal limbo. That review was still underway by Sunday night, and the outcome could determine whether the government must tap its ample resources, totaling into the tens of billions of dollars, to preserve... Just a minute. To preserve full SNAP benefits this month. The Agriculture Department did not respond to a request for comment. The White House office also did not respond. Representative Angie Craig of Minnesota, the top Democrat on the House Agriculture Committee, said in a statement that she believed the Trump administration was demanding that food assistance be taken away from the households that have already received it. They would rather go door to door taking away people's food than do the right thing and fully fund SNAP for November so that struggling veterans, seniors, and children can keep food on the table, she said. The legal wrangling punctuated an anxious weekend for low-income Americans around the country who rely on food stamps. Many reported delays or difficulties in getting their benefits, if they received them at all, impinging on their ability to buy groceries. Even in states that had raced to furnish full benefits in the short window before the Supreme Court intervened, some families had yet to receive any payments and were unsure when they would arrive. I'm still struggling to eat, said Tyrone Green, a 25-year-old student in Niagara Falls, New York, who normally receives about $127 each month under SNAP. By Sunday, friends of hers had received their benefits in New York, which started to release funds on Friday before the Supreme Court weighed in. But Ms. Green said that she was not due to receive her allotment until Tuesday. She said she had already skipped meals and borrowed money from friends. Even for those who did receive food stamps, there was still a fear that the money might not be available when they needed it. On Sunday morning, Jean Neihart, 44, of Anoka, Minnesota, received a text message from a friend who said she had received her food stamp payments for the month. Ms. Neihart immediately logged into an app that allows people enrolled in the program to track their benefits. After app crashes, login difficulties, and about an hour of waiting, she saw that she had received her full monthly benefit of $436, covering both her and her daughter. She said it came as a surprise, as she thought her payment might be delayed for weeks. I had never, until this shutdown, ever worried about SNAP not being funded before. The food stamp program is federally funded, but largely managed by states. To provide benefits, states send files to processors, which administer the electronic benefit transfer system. These vendors then make the funds available on cards, which are the primary way that SNAP recipients purchase groceries. In its guidance, the Agricultural Department late Saturday said states may not send processors the files that would be required to provide full benefits. Rather, the agency said, states must only send files for partial benefits, meaning that food stamp recipients would see their payments substantially cut. To the extent states sent full SNAP payment lists for benefit for November 2025, this was unauthorized, wrote Patrick Penn, a top official at the Agriculture Department. Accordingly, states must immediately undo any steps taken to issue full SNAP benefits for November. David Super, a professor at the Georgetown University Law Center, said it would not be legal for the government to claw back benefits that it had already provisioned without affording people due process. But, Mr. Super added, the federal government sought to thwart the states that hadn't completed their work to release full SNAP allotments to low-income families. He said the memo could serve to scare states partway along the process, and it's telling the states to turn back. In the hours after receiving the memo, some state leaders either publicly refused to comply with the Trump administration or threatened to fight its orders, citing the financial harm that it might inflict on their residents. No, Governor Tony Evers of Wisconsin, a Democrat, said in a statement. He said his state would continue to fight against the Trump administration's efforts to yank food assistance away from Wisconsin's kids, families, and seniors. Wisconsin officials also criticized the federal government on Sunday for trying to obstruct some of the complicated behind-the-scenes transactions that help to reimburse grocers who accept SNAP. They brought it to the attention of a federal judge in Massachusetts who was considering a request by roughly two dozen states, including Wisconsin, to force the Trump administration to restore all SNAP funds. As part of that lawsuit, state leaders also asked the judge on Saturday to shield them from any federal punishment over their handling of food stamps during the current period of legal uncertainty. In a filing, they pointed to a series of conflicting instructions from the Agriculture Department, which at one point had signaled that it was preparing to release the funds for full stamp payments after all. Lawyers for the Justice Department strongly opposed the state's request in a formal reply to the court on Saturday. Their filing came as the Trump administration also ratcheted up its threats to punish local officials for allocating full food stamp benefits. In its memo, the Agriculture Department said that states could lose access to some federal money to manage the SNAP program if they fail to comply and may be liable for funding full benefits that the federal government did not authorize. Senator Amy Klobuchar, Democrat of Minnesota, said the cruelty is the point. In a post on Sunday on social media, she added, it is their choice to do this. And another front page article that kind of complements that one. This is More Tax Breaks for the Wealthy by Jesse Drucker. With little public scrutiny, the Trump administration is handing out hundreds of billions of dollars in tax cuts to some of the country's most profitable companies and wealthiest investors. The Treasury Department and Internal Revenue Service, through a series of new notices and proposed regulations, are giving breaks to giant private equity firms, crypto companies like the one Trump owns, foreign real estate investors, insurance providers, and a variety of multinational corporations. The primary target: the administration is rapidly gutting a 2022 law intended to ensure that a sliver of the country's most profitable corporations pay at least some federal tax. The provision, the corporate alternative minimum tax, was passed by Democrats and signed into law by President Joseph Biden. It sought to stop corporations like Microsoft, Amazon, and Johnson & Johnson from being able to report big profits to shareholders, yet low tax liabilities to the federal government. It was projected to raise $222 billion over a decade. But the succession of notices the Treasury and IRS have issued beginning this summer means that the tax could bring in a fraction of that. These breaks come in addition to the roughly $4 trillion package of tax cuts that Trump signed into law in July. The legislation, passed entirely by Republicans, heavily benefits businesses and the ultra-wealthy. It is projected to add trillions of dollars to the federal deficit and came with steep cuts to health care for older people and food stamps for the poorest Americans. With its various tax relief provisions, and I have to turn the page here. The administration is now effectively adding hundreds of billions of dollars in new breaks for big businesses and investors. The Treasury is empowered to write rules to help the IRS carry out tax laws passed by Congress. But the aggressive actions of the Trump administration raise questions about whether it is exceeding its legal authority. Trump and congressional Republicans have attacked federal workers as instruments of the deep state, exercising power beyond anything authorized by law. Now the administration is doing the same thing, several tax experts said, undermining laws that hit the ultra-wealthy and big companies. Treasury has clearly been enacting unlegislated tax cuts, said Kyle Pomerleau, a tax economist at the American Enterprise Institute, a right-leaning think tank. Congress determines tax law. Treasury undermines this constitutional principle when it asserts more authority over the structure of the tax code than Congress provides it. The alternative minimum tax isn't the administration's only effort to roll back taxes on large businesses and wealthy individuals. Last month, the Treasury and IRS granted new tax relief to foreign investors in U.S. real estate. In August, they withdrew regulations to prevent multinationals from avoiding taxes by claiming duplicate losses in multiple countries at once. And, as the New York Times previously reported, the Treasury and IRS have rolled back a crackdown on an aggressive tax shelter used by big companies, including Occidental Petroleum and AT&T. That amounts to another $100 billion in cuts, and likely far more, according to tax advisors. Changes like these are not widely publicized by the Treasury, but are closely followed by tax planners for the country's biggest corporations, who are applauding the new guidelines. In notes to clients, advisors at KPMG celebrated the new array of choices available for investors seeking to avoid the corporate alternative minimum tax. They noted that the Treasury's moves provided significant flexibility for clients to trim their bills, allowing them to cherry-pick the rules that best suit their needs. A Treasury spokesman said the new moves were a practical approach that supports American investment and competitiveness and were meant to replace the Biden administration's compliance maze that would have buried taxpayers in red tape. The spokesman did not address the issue of whether the Treasury was exceeding its legal authority. The Treasury's actions are probably contributing hundreds of billions of dollars to the federal deficit, tax experts said. That is on top of the trillions that the legislation signed by Trump in July is already adding to the deficit. Yet unlike laws passed by Congress, Treasury is under no obligation to publicly account for revenue lost by its actions, such as cutting spending to offset the money no longer being collected. Doing it through the Treasury means you can just give away the goodies to one group without having to take back anything from another, said Daniel Hemmel, a law professor at New York University. This loophole, he said, is one that previous administrations have exploited and which the Trump administration is exploiting more aggressively. and you're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The actions by Treasury over the past few months are an accelerated version of what the agency did during the first Trump administration. Regulators killed off efforts to crack down on a lucrative estate tax avoidance strategy and watered down new taxes on multinational companies in the 2017 Republican tax package. Big companies effectively keep two sets of books, one for investors and one for the IRS. The profits they report to the IRS permit various deductions that can bring a firm's tax rate far below the 21% corporate tax rate. A holy grail of tax planning is figuring out a deduction that businesses can claim on their return, but one that they don't report to investors, which would dent their profits, potentially hurt their stock price, and thus depress compensation paid to executives. In 2021, the Biden administration was unable to get Congress to sign on to an international plan to tax multinational corporations. So the Democrat-led Congress revived an old idea to potentially achieve similar results by imposing a tax on the same profits that corporations report to their investors. That alternative minimum tax was part of a 2022 domestic policy law called the Inflation Reduction Act. The new tax would apply to big corporations with an effective tax rate below 15%. Not everyone viewed the new tax positively, but it's a thing that they were able to do at the moment in time, said Kimberly Clausing, a top Biden administration Treasury tax official and now a law professor at UCLA. The original proposal was relatively simple, limited to a tiny group of corporations averaging profits of more than $1 billion a year. It would require IRS auditors to look at the income reported to shareholders. If the companies paid taxes at a rate of less than 15% on those earnings, the new tax would kick in. It would hit as few as 80 corporations, according to one study. Industry lobbyists swung into action, and Democrats in Congress began carving out enormous exceptions, permitting reductions for, say, businesses investing in heavy machinery and wireless spectrum used by the likes of T-Mobile and Verizon. As a result of changes like these, the new tax's projected revenue dropped to $222 billion from $319 billion, according to congressional estimates. The amount of revenue is expected to shrink even more, in part because of Treasury's actions. The new law could have swept in two of the biggest crypto firms, Coinbase and Strategy. In response, they sought rule changes for calculating the minimum tax. Three high-powered legal advisors, Michael Desmond, who served as the IRS chief counsel in the first Trump administration, Andrew Strelka, formerly senior tax counsel in the Biden administration, and Eugene Scalia, the labor secretary in the first Trump administration, pushed to exempt mark-to-market gains reported to investors. Those gains reflect the increase in value of the investments held by companies that haven't been sold yet. On September 30th, the IRS granted their request, explicitly citing digital assets. Strategy declared within hours that it no longer expects to become subject to the minimum tax after previously disclosing a potential multi-billion dollar bill under the new tax. So they saved multi-billions of dollars. Coinbase said in a statement that it supported the Trump administration's approach to the regulations for administering the minimum tax. Strategy did not respond to a request for comment. The crypto companies owe tax and they're not happy about it, so they're going to the Trump administration for a special carve-out, complained Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, the ranking Democrat on the tax-writing Senate Finance Committee. Some energy firms are benefiting too. Cheniere Energy, the giant natural gas exporter, disclosed in a securities filing last month that thanks to the most recent Treasury notice, it was entitled to a refund of $380 million of previously paid alternative minimum tax. Private equity firms are yet another beneficiary. Beginning in early 2023, the industry giant Blackstone pressed for a number of provisions to be included in the regulations to administer the minimum tax. This summer, Blackstone succeeded. Much of the recent guidance grants Blackstone's requests, giving private equity firms enormous flexibility to calculate their bills. The regulations also provide new flexibility for insurance companies in using so-called tax losses. For one, the new rules permit some insurers to use these losses to reduce their bills under the minimum tax, even for prior years. They're effectively repealing the statute, said Monty Jackal, a tax lawyer and former IRS official, referring to the minimum tax law. And one more front page story. A proposed two-headed coin would always come up Trump, by Dan Barry. Nearly a century ago, the United States paused its 1920s roar to celebrate the 150th anniversary of the country's birth. There were speeches, a Philadelphia flop of a World's Fair, more speeches, and a commemorative coin mostly remembered now as a numismatic misfire. The 1926 coin featured the long-dead first president, George Washington, beside the very much alive current president, Calvin Coolidge, whose appearance broke with American convention not to depict a sitting president on money. The custom was inspired by Washington himself, who was so anti-monarchical he could have coined the phrase, "No kings." The Washington Coolidge half dollar is the only American coin to feature a sitting president, but not for long. The Treasury Department recently announced plans to celebrate the country's 250th anniversary in 2026 with a $1 coin depicting Trump. In a draft rendering, he appears twice and alone, on the obverse in a profile partly eclipsing the word liberty, and on the reverse, his fist raised below the words, "Fight, fight, fight." The very idea of such a coin reflects the national divide over the Trump presidency. Is depicting the current president on money a pitch-perfect way to celebrate the Declaration of Independence, the world-altering denunciation of royal tyranny? Or is it a tone-deaf overreach with an unabashed l'état, c'est moi vibe? Questions like these have coursed through nearly a quarter millennium of American coinage history as the country has sought to stamp reflections of its ideals on flat, round pieces of metal. Emperors, kings, and rulers had appeared on coins for some 2,000 years by the late 18th century, when the daring democratic experiment known as the United States came into being. Its founding fathers worked to create a constitutional republic after having just extricated the colonies from England, where coins depicting the double-chinned bust of George III jingled a constant reminder of who lorded over whom. Heeding the first president's aversion to anything hinting of monarchy, Congress passed the Coinage Act of 1792, which stipulated that American coins bear an allegorical depiction of freedom along with the inscription Liberty. It did not specifically forbid the use of a president's likeness, but the implication was no images of any leader, past or present. Washington very consciously modeled himself on the Roman leader Cincinnatus, who refused to be a dictator for life and went back to his farm, said Douglas Mudd, the director and curator of the Edward C. Rochette Money Museum in Colorado Springs. That's the foundation of this idea. Robert Julian, a prominent numismatist and artist, agreed. They didn't want people to become bigger than the country itself. They were trying to avoid the way kings and emperors always depicted themselves on coins. The country followed this practice for generations. Coins routinely featured goddess-like personifications of liberty. Early on, she was depicted with windblown hair, but the image was modified amid concerns that she looked as if she had just seen a ghost. The custom was reinforced in the 1860s when Spencer Clark, a currency superintendent and subject of a recent sex scandal, had the temerity and vanity to put his own full-bearded likeness on the 5-cent note. Afterward, a furious Congress passed a law stipulating that no portrait or likeness of any living person hereafter engraved shall be placed upon any of the bonds, securities, notes, fractional, or postal currency of the United States. The law did not specifically mention coins. Still, no American president was depicted on currency until 1909, when Abraham Lincoln appeared on the penny to honor the 100th anniversary of his birth. He was nearly a half century dead by then and a personification of liberty. In 1828, where am I? In 1926, the misbegotten Washington Coolidge half dollar was struck. The coin was meant to symbolize the country's audacious beginnings and prosperous present. Still, Mr. Mudd said, it was unfortunate. Living people have occasionally appeared on commemorative American coins. Among them, Carter Glass, a Virginia senator and devout segregationist, who was featured on a 1936 half dollar recalling the 150th anniversary of the incorporation of Lynchburg, Virginia, and Eunice Kennedy Shriver, whose image adorns a 1995 special dollar, a silver dollar, celebrating the Special Olympics World Games. But no sitting president save Silent Cal. Within days of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in November 1963, the Mint began planning for a coin featuring his likeness. By early 1964, the popular Kennedy half dollar, with the dead president's profile overlapping slightly over Liberty, was being struck. The quickness recalled Beth Deischer, the former editor of Coin World magazine, was very much a reflection of a nation that was grieving. In 2005, Congress authorized circulating commemorative dollar coins honoring each former president, but stipulating that none bear the image of a living former or current president. Lawmakers were so intent on avoiding anything even faintly monarchical that the authorization also declared that none of the commemorative dollar coins featuring a deceased former president could be issued during the 2-year period following the date of the death of that president. Lawmakers were now, 20 years later, the long-standing resolve to reject anything monarchy adjacent has fallen away. That is, at least within the current presidency. Now, 20 years later, the long-standing resolve. Mr. Trump's cabinet members have taken turns in public to flatter him with superlatives. His administration held a rare military parade in June in celebration of the U.S. Army's 250th anniversary, that just happened to fall on his birthday. Bills pending in Congress seek to rename the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts after him and the center's opera house after his wife. And 3 weeks before Trump unilaterally demolished the east wing of the White House, the U.S. Treasurer, Brandon Beach, circulated the draft rendering of the two-headed Trump coin on social media. President Trump is one of the greatest leaders in American history, Mr. Beach, a former Georgia legislator who embraced Trump's lie of a stolen 2020 election, said. He added, millions of Americans are excited by yet another transformative action by the Trump administration. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent soon confirmed plans to issue a coin that, in accordance with the 2020 law, would feature designs emblematic of the United States semi-quincentennial. And he added, there is no profile more emblematic for the front of this coin than that of our serving president, Donald J. Trump. You're listening to a reading of articles and features in the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The legislation that he cited to justify using the image of Trump as emblematic of the country's 250th birthday did not expressly prohibit putting anyone's face on the coins, including the face of someone still breathing, but it did stipulate no head and shoulders, portrait, or bust of any person, living or dead, and no portrait of a living person may be included in the design on the reverse of any coin. This would appear to preclude Trump's image from appearing on both sides of the coin, which is generally considered a numismatic no-no. Mr. Deischer, the former editor of CoinWorld, said that a two-headed coin would be a nightmare to strike because the deepest parts of the coin would be opposite each other. The rendering of the Trump coin, she added, tells me they don't know anything about coinage. The Treasury Department declined to say who first suggested featuring Trump on a coin, or to explain how having two Trumps on one coin would be legal. A department spokeswoman emphasized that while no final design had been chosen yet, this first draft reflects well the enduring spirit of our country. Sorry. Even in the face of immense obstacles. One veteran numismatist seconded the idea of featuring Trump on a coin, notwithstanding American tradition. I think George Washington would approve, said Anthony Swiatek, the author of an encyclopedia of commemorative American coins. Because of all that Trump has accomplished. Utter nonsense, said Douglas Brinkley, a professor of history at Rice University and the author of several books about the presidency. He said the country's 200th anniversary should celebrate the American Republic and its people. Having the sitting president appear on a semi-quincentennial coin, he said, only feeds the cult of an individual perpetrated by that same individual. Exactly what Washington was intent on avoiding. He added, it is anti-American at its core. A central question with any commemorative coin, though, is what is it meant to convey? To Mr. Mudd, the Money Museum director, the draft rendering of a Trump coin is at the very least repetitive, with Trump's image on both front and back, taking up valuable space that could be used to extol virtues. In addition, he said, coins are meant to have a certain timelessness, but he wondered what the raised fist and the words fight, 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 both recalling Trump's response to being wounded in an assassination attempt in 2024, are intended to convey. You have to wonder, what will future generations think, he said. What's he talking about? What were we fighting? This looks more like a political campaign token than a message for the ages. How posterity would judge an American coin featuring a sitting president remains an open question. But if the Washington Coolidge coin of 1926 is any measure, the answer is not well. The U.S. Mint struck a million of the half dollars featuring the first and 30th presidents. Nearly 860,000 of them were returned and melted. And now, an editorial by David French. It's called Cruelty, Bigotry, and Rage. What's not to like? Kevin Roberts, the president of the Heritage Foundation, must be confused. Last month, he turned to the most reliable move in the Republican crisis managed playbook, and it didn't work. On October 30th, 3 days after his friend Tucker Carlson released a softball interview with Nick Fuentes, a Holocaust denier and perhaps the most notorious fan of Adolf Hitler in American political life, Roberts posted a video online that decried cancel culture. We will always defend truth, Roberts said. We will always defend America, and we will always defend our friends against the slander of bad actors who serve someone else's agenda. That includes Tucker Carlson, he continued, who remains, and I have said before, always will be a close friend of the Heritage Foundation. The venomous coalition attacking him are sowing division. Their attempt to cancel him will fail. It's hard to overstate how much this approach tends to work in the modern Republican Party. The hatred of the left and of conservatives who are critical of Donald Trump is so overwhelming that even the most basic acts of moral hygiene are considered weak or woke or worse. Even if you are uncomfortable with the words or actions of your fellow Republicans, there is relentless pressure to swallow your tongue. When Roberts, who was also a guiding force of Project 2025, recorded his video, he could be forgiven for thinking that neither Carlson nor Fuentes was particularly toxic on the right. But Roberts miscalculated. His statement tore the Heritage Foundation apart. Facing a staff revolt, he issued a new statement, more clearly condemning Fuentes, but still leaving Carlson alone. And when that didn't quell the uprising, he held an all-staff meeting that quickly degenerated into an airing of grievances. Roberts remains Heritage's president and has vowed to stay, but senior foundation employees have resigned. The National Task Force to Combat Anti-Semitism has severed its ties with the group, and vast segments of the right are in open revolt against both Roberts and Carlson. Readers might be a little bit stumped. Wait, this is what's splitting the right? A podcast conversation? It's not that dialogues like this don't matter, they do, but after everything that America has seen and endured since 2015, why now? The answer is rooted in part in the unstable bargain that millions of conservatives made with themselves and with America to keep supporting Trump. A movement, especially one that verges on an outright cult of personality, is defined by its leader, not by its rank and file. And when the leader is lawless and depraved, then efforts to contain his influence while preserving his power are doomed to fail. The proof is everywhere. Throughout the Trump era, many of the most prominent voices of right-wing America have only become shriller, angrier, and yes, more racist and more anti-Semitic. The right-wing media universe is culturally different in 2015 than it was in 2025. I think he means that backwards. The right-wing media universe is culturally different in 2025 than it was in 2015. Substantially so. The balance of power has flipped upside down. The fringe has become mainstream, and the mainstream has become fringe. And now, with the end of Trump's presidency coming into view, there is an increasing number of conservatives who fear that the movement has been and is being completely redefined, not just in Trump's image, but in Carlson's and Fuentes's as well. And now some of these conservatives are speaking up. A great deal is riding on their ability to win this fight. Trump will not be president for a third term, and the question of who will represent the Republican Party in the years to come is of immeasurable importance. I want to believe that a large number of conservatives are in the process of waking up. They're finally questioning what their movement has become. But I'm rather afraid that they're too late. One sign that might be the case is that virtually every person who's raised a voice against Carlson has a far smaller audience than he does. Since Carlson posted his interview with Fuentes less than 2 weeks ago on X, it has racked up almost 18 million views. On YouTube, it has 5.8 million. In fact, the Fuentes interview is already Carlson's fourth most popular video, despite being online for less than 2 weeks. If you're wondering, his most popular one is his friendly interview with the even more vile Vladimir Putin. To put those numbers in context, they topped the viewership of his primetime Fox News show when he was the top-rated cable television host in America. Compounding the problem, there are many prominent right-wing influencers who won't explicitly defend Carlson or Fuentes, but will scold the people who are confronting them. Sean Davis, the chief executive of The Federalist, for example, attacked Ben Shapiro after Shapiro condemned both Carlson and Fuentes, writing, "Not really sure I'm willing to be lectured on who is allowed to talk to whom and why by someone yucking it up with Jake Tapper, one of the most corrupt, hateful, and dishonest left-wing operatives masquerading as a journalist in all of media." Got that? We can't condemn good old Tucker for elevating an actual fan of Hitler in front of many millions of people because that will distract from taking on the real enemy, Jake Tapper. I'm tempted to just laugh about it, but the stakes are too high and Davis's sentiments are too popular for me to face the future with anything but real alarm. Making the problem worse, the fight for the future of the Republican Party is taking place only after many of its most thoughtful and decent members have been excommunicated. Millions upon millions of Republicans have been told that these brave men and women, Mitt Romney, Liz Cheney, and Adam Kissinger, to name just three, are traitors to the cause. The Republican rank and file have also been conditioned to dismiss moral arguments against MAGA as sanctimonious and complaints about Republican racism and anti-Semitism as inherently leftist. Hearts are hardened, ears are shut. I don't know if Roberts will survive at Heritage, but I do know that Carlson and Fuentes and their constellation of friends and allies are far too popular to cancel or even to contain. The fight for the future of the Republican Party is underway, but until the demand for decency reaches toward the very top of the movement, then Trump's malignant influence will continue to metastasize, and he'll hand the baton to a woman or a man, including possibly Carlson himself, who extends Trump's legacy of cruelty, bigotry, and rage. And here's another interesting editorial called "Let's Not Party Like It's 1929. It's by William Birdthistle, who's the director of the Division of Investment Management at the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission from 2021 to 2024. President Trump's Halloween party at Mar-a-Lago, set to the theme of the Great Gatsby, reenacted the decadence of that story's licentious era. Befeathered flappers shimmying in the crowd, gilded and onyx decor, scantily clad women posing in an enormous champagne coupe. The revelatory moment says so much about where we stand today and what we could be lurching into next. Published a century ago, F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby captured the culture of an overheated economy on the brink of demise. Just as Jay Gatsby fell from the height of fortune to an ignominious death, the 1920s roared with financial overindulgence until the markets drowned in the Wall Street crash of 1929. The Great Depression followed, and the consequences for the global economy proved calamitous. Today we find ourselves again dancing toward new highs in the stock market. Speculative money is once more pouring into risky investment schemes, with staggering sums of money being thrown at artificial intelligence and cryptocurrencies. But rather than heed a century of hard-won lessons, the Trump administration's financial regulators are embracing dissolute policies to keep the punch flowing. The financial excesses of 100 years ago teach us how high the costs of negligent oversight of our markets can be. When sentinels sleep, fraudsters flourish. Their frenzied celebration of unreal profits pumps froth into the market. Ultimately, with panic and pain, bubbles will burst. As stages of that cycle are recurring, we must decide whether to intervene now or to mop up the mess later. The parallels between the 1920s and the 2020s are numerous and ominous. The 1920s economy boomed while America recovered from a deadly pandemic, the flu of 1918. Americans used installment plans, the precursor to today's ubiquitous buy now, pay later plans at online checkouts, to spend liberally on consumer products, and they poured money into speculative new investments. Automobile and telephone stocks were the high-flying tech investments of their day. Tesla and Apple are two of ours. The prevailing interest rate was around 5%, as it is today. And as with today, masses of Americans took advantage of easy credit and ubiquitous stock brokerages to speculate in finance. In 1929, a New York Times editor quoted a major newspaper's financial experts who said that the huge army that daily gambles in the stock market had come to include, in the editor's words, the woman non-professional speculator whose share of market trading grew by one estimate from less than 2% to 35%. That influx of buying from 1919 to 1929 drove the stock market up more than sixfold over the decade, a growth rate our market has actually surpassed over the past 3 years. Nick Carraway, the narrator of The Great Gatsby, was a bond salesman. Today, he might work for a crypto exchange or Robinhood, the popular app that allows neophytes to bet on financial options like a game on their smartphones. Robinhood makes a good deal of money from the interest its users pay to borrow money to buy yet more investments. Investing on margin, as this practice is known, was a major source of the surge that drove markets to perilous heights in the 1920s. And when stocks began to fall, margin calls, the demands for loans to be repaid by selling the stocks, if necessary, were a major accelerator of the crash. In the 1920s, America did not have any federal securities regulators, offering irresistible temptations to the charlatans. And you're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. It was the era of Charles Ponzi, whose last name became synonymous with the classic pyramid scheme in which outlandish returns are delivered only by pilfering the funds of new investors. Today's analogous innovation is the cryptocurrency rug pull, in which investors are lured by stories of stratospheric returns on new tokens, only to be left with little or nothing when the promoters disappear with their assets. Without federal rules to force financial advisors to disclose essential facts about their offerings, they could easily dupe mom-and-pop investors into buying worthless investments at inflated prices. Another racket involved advisors buying a stock, directing their fund to invest in it, and profiting from its rise in price. A rising tide lifted even the least seaworthy financial tubs. Ultimately, the unsustainable cannot be sustained. Between 1929 and 1932, the stock market dropped 77%, and the global economy staggered into the Great Depression, while unemployment and malnutrition spiked. In 1932, suicide rates soared to their highest in recorded history. Financial failure on such a massive scale taught America important lessons, including the need for prudent regulation. Franklin Roosevelt, who swept into the presidency with 472 of 531 electoral votes and a mandate to launch his New Deal, signed waves of legislation to restore confidence in the American financial system, including the securities laws that created federal rules and an agency, the Securities and Exchange Commission, dedicated to their enforcement. The chief mandate of those rules was to ensure that anyone soliciting investment from the public told the world about their operations and was held responsible if they omitted crucial information or materially misstated the facts. Any companies that chose not to release such information would have to limit their pitch to small numbers of investors or to sophisticated investors who could fend for themselves. This policy has worked spectacularly well for decades, pulling America's capital markets out of the smoldering ruins of devastation to become the largest, deepest, and most efficient in the world. 4 years ago, the economist Robert Shiller expressed concern about the stock market's lofty heights, but he concluded that there was no particular reason to expect a market collapse as bad as the 1929 crash, because the government and the Fed have shown themselves to be far more adept in staving off prolonged recessions than their predecessors. Today, with the S&P over 60% higher than it was the day Mr. Shiller issued his warning, we should be heeding the words of the former Federal Reserve Chairman William McChesney Martin, who warned that market stewards must be willing to serve as the chaperone who can order the punch bowl removed just when the party was really warming up. Trump has been ordering the chaperones removed. Since January, his administration has been firing regulators and vigorously tearing down the guardrails that have kept our markets thriving for 9 decades. For the first time in a century, the SEC is seriously exploring how to allow firms and funds to sell investments to masses of Americans without registration or disclosure. The administration is even encouraging individual retirees to vouchsafe their life savings to exotic financial offerings like private equity. Private equity is, as the name suggests, notoriously opaque, which means retirees would know little about what they're investing in. The White House and the private fund lobby argue that this policy will democratize access to alternative assets and promote better returns, But such a plan, which comes with neither the information nor the protections needed to defend investors from serious economic risks, is as compelling as a plan to democratize brain surgery. Trump is also allowing financial regulators to atrophy. The five-person Commodity Futures Trading Commission, tasked by this administration to oversee significant portions of the crypto and prediction market, has dwindled to a single member. Lost my place. Only two of five statutorily mandated SEC commissioners are serving in their normal terms. The lone remaining Democratic appointee, Carolyn Crenshaw, is in her post-expiration grace period and warning that the agency's policies are a reckless game of regulatory Jenga. The agency's chair has declared a new day at the SEC, but the lamps are going out all over the agency. Staff has been cut by 16%, substantially more than a 10% of a literal decimation. Quarterly reports are on the chopping block, and forms that provide intelligence about dark corners of the market are being repeatedly deferred. Meanwhile, Trump is relentlessly browbeating the Federal Reserve to lower interest rates. That could also, as it did in the 1920s, overstimulate an already lofty stock market. And all that money chasing too few goods is what leads to inflation, a problem that takes longer to develop and is devastating when it arrives. Trump may no longer be president when that bill comes due. For now, his administration is stamping on the gas while turning off the headlights. And as Fitzgerald warned us in the climactic scene of The Great Gatsby, terrible consequences come from automobile accidents in the gathering darkness. Trump may want to take a moment to recall that neither the novel nor the 1920s ended well. Wise rules are a source of abundance. Well-regulated systems attract users, just as well-regulated markets attract investors. This administration professes to be so concerned about lawlessness that it is deploying troops to confront American citizens and our own cities, while it removes the constables patrolling our financial markets. The U.S. capital markets became the world's largest, not despite regulation, but because of it. Well, that was scary. I have to find out what my investments are in. Here's something potentially positive to end with. This is an article called "Strewn by a Storm, Alaskan Artifacts Await Rediscovery" by Sachi Kijama Mulkey. The morning after a storm slammed into western Alaska last month, Jimmy Jones was collecting driftwood on the beach near Quinahagak, a fishing village. When he reached to pick up a log, a face stared up at him from the sand beneath. For a split second, he worried that he had found a human body, but looking closer, he realized it was a wooden mask with delicate traces of paint staining the surface. The remnants of Typhoon Halong, which killed at least one person and displaced hundreds from flooded homes around the region, had also swept up and carried thousands of artifacts from an archaeological site 3 miles south called Nunalek. Some of the artifacts are 600 years old, left behind by the ancestors of the Yupik who live in Quinahagak today. In addition to upending life for residents, the storm ate into 60 feet of shoreline in a single night, destroying the dig site. In the days that followed, Quinahagak residents rushed to recover the artifacts washed ashore. There are most likely hundreds of village sites along the coast of western Alaska where the frozen ground can preserve objects for centuries, but excavation is rare. Like many native communities, Quinahagak's leaders initially felt that any disturbance of the site, which is considered sacred and contains human remains, would be a breach of cultural values. "The artifacts were waiting for us to tell their story," said Warren Jones, Jimmy Jones's father and the chief executive, Quanertunk, the corporation that owns the tribe's land and represents its interests to the U.S. government. "We have to do this for the future generation. They need to know where each and every one of us came from," he said, recounting how he had persuaded the community to support the dig. If we don't, all these artifacts are going to be washed out. Saving artifacts like these is all the more urgent as climate change bears down on the Arctic. As the planet warms and sea levels rise, shorelines are slowly eroding, even without a burst of damage from a typhoon. Sea ice now forms later in the year, giving more time for that erosion to happen. And the thaw of Arctic soils, known as permafrost, has caused the objects tucked inside it to begin decomposing. Archaeologists in Greenland have found remains of animal and human skeletons softening into a mush they call butter bone. The warming climate may also be enabling disasters, like Typhoon Halong, said Rick Tamman, a climate specialist at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. Before 2022, he said, there was only one reliably recorded instance of a typhoon tracking far enough north to reach the Arctic. In recent years, there have been three. The Nunavik dig began in 2009. A few years after the older Mr. Jones reached out to Richard Knecht, an archaeologist at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland, the small town now boasts what is quite likely the largest collection of Yupik artifacts in the world. There are nearly 200,000 preserved in a cultural center that doubles as an archaeologist lab and a museum. Dr. Knecht, who has retired from the university but continues to lead the work, has seen coastal erosion destroy indigenous heritage sites before. In the early 2000s, rising sea levels claimed a dig near Kodiak, Alaska, that he had been studying for nearly 20 years. Still, the damage to Nunavik last month took his breath away. And you've been listening to a reading of articles and features on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, from the New York Times, that is. This is Ted. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope none of these articles scared you too much. And I'll be with you next week again. Hope you liked it. Bye.